And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
/7:55 is real with David O'Brien and Erica Flaherty is on the air now. Welcome back to 7:55 is real. I'm David O'Brien, Braves writer for The Athletic, with my co-host, as usual, Erica Flaherty. It's been a while, Eric. What's up, man?
Not much. How you hanging?
Good. Seems like only yesterday. Braves are celebrating, but it's actually been what, close to a month? Yeah, it's been a month.
It's been about a month.
Yeah. Wow. I think it's a shame. And well, let's go ahead and introduce. We got a very special guest today. You guys know him. You love him. The great Dale Murphy. Murph, what's going on, man?
Oh, hi, David. Just getting ready for Christmas. Hey, Eric, how you doing? Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah.
You know, I always wonder how, like, having Eric on here, we talked about, you know, what it, and we had Kelly Johnson on here. We talked about what it means when the team goes does so well for guys, for what they say, alumni. And I can imagine for a guy who is so identified with a team, what it must have been like for you to see the Braves march to the World Series after all these years to win it all again.
Wow. I mean, where do you start with this year? What a
yeah.
I think a number of people on social media have said if there was ever going to be a movie made, this would be a great one. It was storybook. And I think a lot of us alumni my age, you know, had a connection with Brian and Ronnie Snicker. Yeah. So that, you know, it just was, he's easy to, it is an easy team to pull for, and great personalities, just everything clicked, got hot at the right moment. But I think my connection really is Brian Snicker. I mean, it was just, you know, he's just so fun. I can't remember when it was. It's when I threw out the first pitch, actually, in the Dodgers series. But you know, I go over there, and security, as you guys know, is like unreal.
Yeah.
And they're going, "Hey, Murph, we're just warning you. You can't go in the dugout. No one is allowed in the dugout." So, you know, they're going to cut. The coaches will come up and say hi to you. I said, "Hey, yeah, no problem." So I'm just sitting there saying hi to the coaches, and Snit goes, "Hey, is that your son Jake and his wife over there?" And I think he's met Jake, a couple times. I go, "Yeah, that's Jake. They were just over, by the box seats." And Jake goes, "You know, Brian Snicker came over to talk to us, and Jake said, I was getting kind of uncomfortable because I figured there's something he must have to go do. He spent so much time with us." And it was just so nice, a little gesture like that, Brian Snicker. But, you know, he has that personality that endears you to him. The guys love to play for him. That's the kind of personality you need to lead through the ups and downs and he's got it. So, you know, we go back so many years. If you were in the Braves organization, I mean, Bob Horner texted me. He goes, this is unreal, man. I'm going crazy. So, you know, that was a fun connection for sure.
Yeah, that was that example you cited of Snit. That's the way he is, because there'll be times we'll be waiting for him, a post-game interview or, you know, whenever we're going to get him. And he'll be 5-10 minutes late because he's doing something like that. He thinks nothing of – he will not pull himself away from someone if it's someone he knows and someone he the personal thing to him is so much more important than anything else. And he won't be rude and tell somebody, you know, or shorten a conversation to get over to an interview with us or whatever. So, you know, he's got his priorities straight. You know,
yeah,
the human relationships is most important to him. And that's why he's so good.
Yeah.
That's why he's so good running the team.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I get to speak a lot, and it's just so applicable or applicable. How do you say that? I always say that wrong.
I think it's both ways yeah, are used.
It's your choice.
Okay.
I like applicable, okay, but either
applicable.
Either applies.
Okay. No matter what you're doing, work, family, professional baseball, you know, when whatever group you're part of, you know, helping motivate people is about your relationship with people. It's not about the money that people are making. Certainly that's a motivation, but ultimately the best, you know, a motivator is a relationship between your leader.
And, yeah, for sure.
You know, and Eric, you've played for good ones. I don't know if you played, I hate to say bad ones because they're, you know, if they're major league managers, they're good.
Less good ones. They're,
yeah. But there's just some guys you click with. I click everybody, you know, everybody kind of clicks with Snit, Bobby Cox. I clicked with Joe Torre, and he went on to, you know, be a great manager and leader. I just got to share this one story. I've been sharing it a lot. Is Tyler Matzek said, we just go to, you know, he puts his trust in us, putting us out there again. And we just try to go out there and earn that trust. And, you know, because midway through the season, everybody was taking a lot of heat.
Yeah.
And Snits just keep putting them out there, you know, and
never pointing fingers.
Right. And they just gelled. And that's what kept them together. You know, is Snit is the personality and the ability as a leader to keep a team cohesive during really tough times.
I would think no more so than with a pitching staff, right, Eric? I mean, a bullpen, it can be so right. easy for things to turn south in a bullpen if the manager doesn't show the trust in them and the belief in them. Mismanages them, doesn't handle them right, points fingers at them, that kind of thing. I could see something where that group, which is by itself during the game, where things could turn south. But if you have a guy like Snit, they want to, you know, run through a wall for, like Matzek always says, you know, then that's key, man, to get to 106 months.
Yeah. I mean, I had plenty of managers that when they handed you the ball, that like Mike Hargrove used to always tell me, you know, it's you versus him. Give me your best stuff and we'll see what happens. You know, something kind of along those lines. He'd hand me the ball kind of firm. I had another manager that I could tell he didn't feel confident bringing me in, but he'd just kind of be like, well, here you go. And just kind of hand me the ball and look away and start walking off. I'd be like, you know, shit, you don't feel as good, you know, with that motivation.
Yeah.
But I think probably the best thing Snit did was stick with Will Smith toward the end of the season.
Yeah.
When he was really struggling and everybody wanted him to, you know, maybe have Luke Jackson or Matzek or somebody else step into that role for a little bit. But Snit saw the value in, if Will Smith can get through this period right here and be locked in for the playoffs, now we got a closer for the playoffs. If you start playing that guessing game where every time a guy struggles, you throw somebody else in the role, it puts so much more pressure on everybody else that, you know, you wind up having this complete turnover every time somebody struggles, and guys will really fall into a spot where they're second guessing themselves when they come into a game and worried about losing their role. So I thought that was the best thing he did, and it played huge dividends in the playoffs.
Yeah, I thought it played, and I thought that had a huge effect, not just on the bullpen, but the entire team to see the confidence that Snit showed in Will Smith. If Will Smith was going to go down, Snit was going down with him. You know, I mean, he was like, I'm not going to bail on this guy and get in panic and concede to all those who want to, you know, like me, who I wrote that, he should make a change. I wrote that. And then Will proceeded to have that game in San Diego where after that, he just gave up nothing. He got out of that bases loaded situation with no outs. And after that, it was night and day. I mean, the rest of the season. So down the stretch when it was needed most in the regular season and then throughout the postseason, the guy was just lights out.
And that's the game he needed, was that game right there where, you know, everything could all fall apart. His back was against the wall. He dug deep and got out of it. And he rode from there.
He went with, and he stuck with Smiley earlier in the year, too, in a rotation. He stuck with Smiley. And Smiley reeled off that month where he was the best starter on the team. You know, where they would, you know, he was really important there for over a month.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so interesting to hear you talk about these things because, Eric, I'd imagine in a bullpen, you guys talk a little bit down there too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, you know, the managers that are kind of guessing or getting nervous, hitting that panic button for sure.
Absolutely. The great, great Whitey Herzog, you know, it's just like he had the tools, but when you're looking at the other side and this manager is making every right move, it's really a challenge. And when the manager starts making moves, not only the bullpen starts talking, but everybody starts talking. Then you start, it snowballs. But it can go south in such a hurry. But I think the Will Smith, David, what you said there, he was going to go down with Will Smith. A manager, that's the crux of a manager's life and decision, because a manager has to trust people that his job depends on.
Yeah.
And a lot of managers do not like to do that.
Yeah.
They want to be the guy. They want to be the guy that made the change. And then they can't get second guessed.
That's how a lot manage is to answer questions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, no, Will Smith was struggling. What did you expect me to do?
Right.
You know,
give up on him.
And then
take the easy route.
The manager's off the hook.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Bobby Cox was almost loyal to a fault early in his career. I mean, he stuck with guys. But over the course of a career, it pays off, because it's like, no, I see what I see. My pitching coach is telling me what, you know, Will Smith is going to be okay, you know. And so we're sticking with him. And, boy, when you start playing that game of moving everybody around because your job's on the line, and it's a hard position to be as a manager, boy, not panicking and having trust in your guys. Wow, that's, you know, because you're the guy that gets fired. Yep. You're the guy that gets fired. And it's a really interesting example and exercise in leadership.
I think that dynamic is why in today's game, where so many teams are hiring young managers that know that they're going to listen to what the front office and the analytics people want them to do. There's a plus to that, obviously, but there's a big negative to that, in that a guy with the gravitas of Bobby Cox, or a guy with like Snit, who's at the point of his career, who doesn't give a shit. If you're going to fire me, I don't have to have this job. I love this job, but I don't have to have it. I will be glad to walk off and play with my grandkids for the rest of my life. I'm fine. I've done enough.
Yeah.
So a guy who's got that, or with like Bobby Cox, who just had so much gravitas and future Hall of Famer, and everybody knew it. Nobody's going to mess with Bobby Cox. So he's going to make decisions that he is confident with, not worry about getting fired. And these younger managers, they aren't going to do that. They're beholden to the front office and the analytics department, and haven't established themselves. They're so easily replaced, and players see everything. So players obviously see that when they got a manager who's going to make the decision that he believes in. He's not going to worry about, you know, getting fired or passing blame or pointing fingers or, you know, what you were talking about.
It's easy to follow the numbers. And then the bottom line is you have an out.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, no, I did this, and that's what the front office wanted me to do. And, you know, everything's cool. So you're right. Blending analytics and personal relationships, what motivates athletes. And again, like Eric said, it can go south so quick.
So fast.
Yeah.
As soon as you make a move and point to the front office as the reason you made that move, you take a guy out of a game, make a pitching change, do a lineup change, and as soon as you just point up top and say that's what they want me to do, you lose the whole clubhouse that day.
Yeah, yeah, it happens quick. It's crazy, but that's the nature of the people forget. They watch them play, and it looks easy, and you forget there's so much
human
emotion. Yeah, I mean, you're on the. I felt, you know, I played with Bob Horner, who never seemed to be in a slump. I mean, I always felt like I was kind of on a knife edge.
Me too.
I was like, people don't realize how close you are to, you know, going 0-16.
And maybe never getting out of it.
Yeah. And you're like, man, we're human beings. And boy, that relationship is comforting, is motivating. If, you know, if I go over 12, you know, Snit's going to stick with me. You know, yep. it's a really interesting thing to watch. And especially this year when, you know, when it works out, it doesn't always work out, but boy, it did this year and it pays dividends. When those relationships, and I always say, you don't have to take guys out to dinner every night. That's not what we're talking about.
Right. Just have their back.
It's little, you know, it's little things. Like Eric said, Hargrove used to say, hey, you know, just this little thing. It's you and him. Go get him. You know, that kind of stuff. People don't think it works, you know, at the highest level of sports, but it does. It's important. I should say, not that it works, but it's important.
We've talked about this, how Snit follows Bobby's example, or his relationship with players, which, I mean, he couldn't have had a better, as far as being a players manager, could not possibly have a better relationship with his players. Yet he's not one of those managers that goes through the clubhouse every day, shaking their hands, talking to them.
Right.
He delegates, and he keeps the distance from his players when it comes to that. And he doesn't feel like he's in with them and all that. Snit doesn't do that either. He's never in the clubhouse. He goes, you'll almost never see me in the clubhouse. Yeah. That's their place. You know, so he keeps that proper distance, yet has that great relationship and respect to the players.
I never saw him in the clubhouse. I don't think I can remember a single time, even when he was a third base coach.
Uh-huh.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah, that's cool. It's the player's place. And that, I guess that makes it, when you get called into his office, makes it a little extra special.
It means something.
It means something. And I think, Soler, I heard this story somewhere. He called Soler in when he came over. He goes, hey, I haven't watched any of your at-bats. I don't know. You know, I'm trusting, you know, our scouts. And we're starting from ground zero with me, man. Go get them. Or whatever he said, you know, I don't know. I don't know what, I don't know if I'm saying what I'm trying to say, but he's like, hey, you know, go get him. I'm happy to have you here. And we're excited. And just a little, you know, a little thing like, you know, the past is the past.
Yeah.
Go get him.
Eric, let's hear from today's sponsors.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
And speaking of Soler, another example of Snit and what he does so well is he listened to Seitzer and Nachi, Castro, his assistant. They watched some video of Soler in his last 9 games with Kansas City. Soler only hit like 192 with KC, but his last 9 games, he had like 4, 5, 6 home runs. He had a couple of 2-homer games. So he had really made an adjustment and turned it around. So never mind what his overall numbers were there. Seitz, because they got him. When they got him, Alex told Snit, we're getting this guy as a bench guy, a platoon guy, use him, you know, however you see fit, but that's what we're getting him for. Seitz and Castro, they watched him and go, Snit, I think we have to reconsider with this guy as an everyday guy. Like, I've seen his swings and what we're seeing. And also, he had EY said, you know, I can work with this guy. He's got the tools. I can make him a decent outfielder. He's okay outfielder. He's not going to hurt us out there. So Snit said, all right, listen to those guys. Said, he's in there every day then. And so he went with him every day to start, see what he could do, and look what he did. If they'd have just got him and stuck with Alex's plan, which was, you know, to platoon this guy, they would have never seen what he did in an everyday lineup and leading off. He would have been a bench guy and a platoon guy. And what does he end up being? A World Series MVP.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a great story. I've been saying that this World Series was the Scouts World Series. And now since you shared that story, I'll go to the coaches. You know,
yeah.
This World Series was a coach and scout victory.
True, I mean, team effort. Front office, coaches, scouts, everybody. Snit, we're all so instrumental, in addition, obviously, to the players first and foremost.
Yeah. And when you get a relationship with your coaches to the point where you're trusting them because that's their job, and then you trust your scouts, you trust your coaches. And Bobby Cox used to say, look, I remember him saying, when they bring a guy up from AAA, it's my whole organization is telling me he's ready. I'm not going to give up on him in 10 days.
Right.
You know,
right.
This is the major leagues. But to Snit here, a positive scouting report about Solaire, and then instead of being nervous, like, you know, do I want to control this? It's like, let these people do their jobs, trust them. And it's a marvelous thing to watch. It doesn't guarantee you success, but it increases your odds. That's what you want. You just want to, you want to increase your odds of winning games. And it worked. And that's how it's supposed to work. It's a great, great year in so many ways, not only the personal individual performances on the field, but boy, you're right, Dave. What a whole organizational effort.
I mean, this was a classic example. We've talked about chemistry all the month. People probably get tired of us talking about team chemistry, but this year was the epitome of what team chemistry can mean for a team. Because I mean, the Braves, what do? They go in, they beat the Brewers. They were not favored to beat the Brewers. Everybody picked the Brewers. They certainly were not favored to pick the Dodgers. I was one of the few people that even picked them, and that's only because I saw this team every day. But nationally, nobody picked the Braves to beat the Dodgers. Maybe Buster Olney did. That's it. They beat a 106-win Dodger team that had just beaten a 107-win Giants team. Here the Braves win 88 games, but people that had watched them down the stretch knew those last 2 months. This was night and day team. It all came together, and this team was playing as well or better than anybody when it got to the postseason. And that's the whole key, being on the same page and playing and clicking when the postseason starts, and they were. I mean, this was a triumph over – this was a triumph of team chemistry, guys really loving each other and playing for each other and willing to give up the individual stats. And all these guys that were in free agent walk years that they picked up, they could have been pissed for not playing every day down the stretch. Those four outfielders they got, a guy like Jock Peterson, they could have been malcontents or being mopes. But instead, Jock goes in there in the Brewers series and gets three pinch hit at bats, and it's two homers and a single in those three at bats.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come on. I mean, that's it. You know, and a guy like Rosario, who was hurt when the Braves first got him for 5 weeks, was on the DL still, the IL. He had to work his way into the lineup, and he did. He had that hit for the cycle game against the Giants out there in San Francisco. But he had to work his way into the lineup. But he didn't complain or say, "Look, I shouldn't have to work my way into the lineup. I should be playing over some of these guys." So it was just one after another guy who kind of gave up the individual accolades and didn't worry about that, and it paid off in the end with Solaire being a World Series MVP, Rosario the NLCS MVP. Peterson, the two pinch hit homers in a Brewer series, would have been the NLDS MVP if they had one.
If they had one.
It was crazy, man. I mean, just the guys that Alex added and how they fit into a clubhouse that welcomed them and embraced them more than any other clubhouse might have. I mean, they made these guys feel comfortable from day one, you know?
Yeah.
How Heredia made Solaire feel. Solaire said, "I'm an introvert. I don't really talk to guys." And I would have been, I would have been so uncomfortable in the clubhouse for that first month or so if I didn't have Heredia, a fellow Cuban who's the ultimate extrovert, who from day one took him around and introduced him to everybody. And Solaire said, "I felt comfortable from day one." So he goes out and just rakes from the get-go, which he would have, he wouldn't have been a contributor probably at all, if he had felt, withdrawn and in the corner the whole time when he got here.
That's awesome. I think this would be a better movie than Moneyball.
It'd be a good one. And you tie in the Snitker story and all that,
And the Snitker, because look, Moneyball.
And a guy like Wash.
Yeah.
What he meant to this team, what he's done for guys like Ozzie.
Absolutely. Moneyball, look, it was the pitching staff.
Yeah, exactly. That hardly got any kind of credit in that movie. The pitching staff was killing it, man. Those three starters.
I, I think Huddy had something like 8 no decisions.
Yeah,
that year. You know, going into the 8th and 9th every game, getting no decisions. But point is, this team is chock full of personalities and stories and human drama or whatever you want to call it. I just think it's so compelling. And I think, this is why we're never going to forget this one as Braves fans. This just was, or members of the Braves, franchise or whatever you want to call us. I'm a fan and an alumnus, but it's just weird.
Isn't that a weird spot to be in? Where you kind of don't know whether to call yourself a fan or really what you are. People
congratulate you. Eric's talking about when people congratulate him for the Braves winning.
I'm getting stuff all the time. Hey, nice going. Congratulations. I'm like, I just say thank you.
Yes. Way to go, man. Like, thanks.
Yeah, I did my part out here in Utah. I did my part.
And helped build in the early 2010s.
But it's cool. And, this is going to be one for the ages. It really is.
Which brings us to trying to repeat. Nobody's been able to do it since the Yankees. Nobody's done it this century, man. And I think that underscores how hard it is to win a championship. And I think in baseball more than any other sport, how hard it is. Because one or two guys can't turn it around like they can in basketball. You can't get LeBron and he signs a couple of his buddies, gets a couple of his buddies to come over and sign, and you guys can win the NBA championship. You can't do that in baseball. It's got to all come together. And you got to ride for 6 months and hope it all is healthy and coming together at the right time. I mean, it's tough, man. And you got 29 other teams. About 20 of them are trying to do the same thing.
Absolutely. And after you do it like they did it, those 20 say, we can do that.
Yes, exactly.
They won 88 games. We just got to get into the playoffs. But the NFL, take the quarterback position, Tom Brady.
Right.
I mean, it's such a impactful and controlling force, whereas you do need 25 guys, and it is it's going to be tough to repeat. But I'll tell you, the Eastern Division I still think is up for grabs. So
Mets this year. Talking about chemistry, look at the Mets this year, man. I mean, they led that division for over half the season, and look where they were at the end. And I think that was a case of the opposite as what the Braves had, that vibe the Braves had, that chemistry.
Absolutely.
That how the Braves never had a big losing streak. They never felt like things could fall apart, When they lose 3 or 4 in a row, they'd snap out of it, and they always stayed there right below 500 until they took off, knowing that they could go on a run, and eventually they did. The Mets obviously didn't have that because they were in first place, and once things went south, they just really went south, and they just fell apart down the stretch.
Yeah, and like we said earlier, it's weird how quick it can go. Like in 2 weeks, the Mets were out of it. I mean,
well, that's where that leadership comes in.
Right.
You got to have somebody come into that clubhouse and calm everybody down.
I think it's good for the Braves that the Mets, the A's, are screwing up in that they're not going to hire Ron Washington. Because I know as much as everybody wants to see Wash get another chance and all that, for selfish reasons, Braves fans should be very happy because Wash is not a guy that's going to mope and go, I should get another chance and be bitter. Wash is going to be out there busting his ass like he does every day, doing his work. He was doing those pregame drills with his guys before game 6 in the Astros, making a little spot like 20 feet long with all the media around him so that he could still do his little fungo drills before game 6 of the World Series, man. That's what he is. So by the A's and the Mets going with a guy that's they're comfortable with the analytics and the front office, and a guy that maybe doesn't have some baggage like Wash has, or he's not up, closer to 70 than he is to 50, or closer to 70 than he is to 60 for that matter. They're screwing up, but it's going to pay off for the Braves because this guy is huge for the Braves as part of that coaching staff and that whole motivating force that they have. It looks like they're going to have Wash back. And I mean, if you're going to try to repeat, that would have been – Wash would have been as hard to replace as anybody other than, say, Freddie Freeman,
That's a good – that's an interesting point. People don't understand coaches' roles and the value of coaches that take their job. Oh, man, I'll tell you one thing. it's a different world than when I played. I mean, I know what time they get going in spring training. I never would have made any of those early workouts. I mean, you know, they're there at the ballpark 5:30 or yeah. six, you know, getting ready to go, and Wash is a, you know, is yeah, I couldn't agree more what he does. And, you know, those things he does, gym drill and funnel stuff. It's everyday stuff. This is what I tell people. Freddie Freeman does everyday fundamental stuff. You know, things are going good, things are going bad. But your coaches have to put in that time behind the scenes and not get a lot of credit. And again, it show to what Wash does with his players shows that he loves his players.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much, you know, they need work on their fundamentals. Everybody does.
Right.
But it's like, no, I want you to be the best you can be. So I'm going to sacrifice my time and I'm going to be there, you know, at noon. We're getting ready to go. So
he's there every day. I saw Marcus Semien said the other day, I actually watched this whole thing kind of unfold. Cause I was with Oakland when Semien got called up and was going to play shortstop, and he was a disaster at shortstop. And they knew he could hit, but he was just, you know, booting balls, throwing balls away. And they hired Ron Washington almost specifically to work with him. And he had Marcus working his ass off day in, day out. It was almost like it was a running joke in the clubhouse. Anytime you saw Semien without Ron Washington by him or talking to him or working with him. But Semien went on and turned himself into a really good defensive infielder. And then he signed that deal with the Rangers the other day. And he said that Ron Washington was the most influential baseball man in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. I mean, that's just one guy.
And what's his name? Gave Wash a gold glove in Oakland for turning him into a gold.
Chavez.
Gave Wash one of his gold gloves. Yeah.
Wow. That's
every day.
And if you see if Ozzie Albies wins a gold glove, it will not surprise me at all if he gives it to Wash, because he gives Wash so much credit for what he's done. But I think what Murph said is so important. Cool. It's not just that he's making them better fielders, which he is, but it's more, I think more importantly, it's showing them how much he loves them. And being out there every day, can be 100 degrees in Atlanta and dripping humidity, and he's out there. This guy's on pushing 70, you know, that he's not getting paid extra for being out there. He could come and start his job when normal coaches do it in the afternoon, but he's out there that extra hour working with these guys one-on-one. Hell, he's out there for 10 minutes working with this ball boy that he's just taken under his wing. There's a ball boy that plays like local high school ball. And he's out there with this ball boy every day after the other guys have all doing it and everybody's going inside to eat, you know, after batting practice. He'll give that ball boy 10 minutes every day hitting fungos to him, getting paid absolutely nothing, getting no credit for that at all, just because he wants to see it. This black kid, this young kid, he wants to see him be the best he can be. So he's out there working with him every day, man.
It's a lot of people would say, well, isn't that what coaches do?
No. See, it's not them sleeping on the couch before the game.
And every coach does that.
And they are not paid well for what they do. Coaches aren't.
Oh, boy.
Managers are getting decent pay now. Managers get paid well. Coaches still are way down, with a few exceptions.
Oh, my gosh.
Coaches, if you broke it down in the hours they work, it's not a lucrative job by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
And they are talking about being hired to be fired. Hitting and pitching coaches, there is no there is no job security in those jobs. It don't matter how big your name is as a hitting coach. I mean, how many guys have we seen be the flavor of the day? You know, the way they teach hitting, they're the flavor of the day for a year or two, and then they're gone, and you're like, whatever happened to? I mean, that's just nature of the business, which is what Seitz is, shows you how good Seitz is and the relationship he builds that he's done it that long.
That's true. Just as a little anecdote, I was talking to Wally Joyner after the World Series, and of course he's from the Atlanta area, but he goes and he was hitting coach for the Phillies, for Detroit, and you know, post career. But anyway, he knows hitting really good. Anyway, he goes, I love watching the World Series. He goes, I saw a lot of Kevin Seitzer in those hitters. He goes, I know Seitz really well. I think going back to, I don't know where Wally played, maybe Kansas City with him, but He goes, mm-hmm. he was really happy for Seitz, and he could see the impact, you know, on guys. So that was cool.
That's another part of the season that will be forgotten by anybody that wasn't close to the team, was what Seitz went through. This is a guy that had a hip replacement surgery in the middle of the season. His hip went. Oh, yeah. His hip started barking like 2 months into the season to where he could not walk. And one day it went out. They were on the road in Miami or at Houston, and they had to bring an ambulance. They had to take him out on a stretcher to have emergency hip replacement surgery. After he had the surgery, missed a road trip, was back in the dugout the next homestand way sooner than he should have been, right? But then they went on a road trip and the hip locked up. It had the replaced hip, the ball had come out of the socket, locked up. He said, I've never been in any kind of pain like that in my life. I told my wife, if I ever have to happen again, shoot me, because I can't go through it again. It was like 3 hours. He was screaming. They had to bring an ambulance, take him to the hospital to have an emergency to work that thing back in. They had to put him on, deaden it and put it back in. This was in the middle of the season.
Oh my, I'm telling you, David, look, David, you're the writer. Have you ever written a screenplay? I mean, there's so much going on in this thing. It's just, I had not heard that. And that's unreal.
He was walking so bad for about a week before the surgery that he was limping off to look like he'd been shot. I mean, he couldn't hardly walk, and he finally had the hip replaced during the road trip.
Wow.
And then had to have it redone, or, had to get that thing back in place when it hopped out. Guys, let's take a quick break, and then we'll finish up the show.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Getting back to trying to repeat, obviously a big part of this is going to be Freddie Freeman. Murph, are you as surprised as we all are that Freddie wasn't re-signed last spring, before we even got to spring training last offseason? If not during the offseason, I thought they would have got it done during spring training like they used to do with Chipper. Chipper never entered a season in the last year of his contract. They always made sure that he was re-signed.
Really?
Every time. Yeah, he never entered a season without a new contract. I was shocked that they didn't with Freddie, but then I realized – coming off that pandemic season, things were strange, and I knew Liberty Media, they're business, and they wanted to see how profits bounced back, attendance, all that, maybe to get a better feel for what they could offer him. Okay, so that's their excuse for the first quarter, second quarter. They see the earnings go through the roof. I mean, this team's making money now. We know that, hand over fist. The battery came back. It's thriving. It's going great. Gangbusters. So the second and third quarter, they're making money at the levels are higher than they did in 19 before the pandemic. The attendance is the second highest in baseball this year behind the Dodgers. And it's only going to spike now with the World Series. So I thought that they ran out of reasons or excuses to not get this done when they didn't do it. I thought maybe they'd wait till when the All-Star game was going to be here. They'd make a big thing out of it and sign him, during the All-Star break maybe. So then that went past. Then they had a chance before the postseason started. In those days there, they could have got done. Anyway, my I guess my long-winded question to you is, are you as surprised as we are that they did not get him re-signed yet, that he went to free agency?
Yeah, I think you're closer to the situation. But for someone who's you know, more of looking at it from a fan's perspective, yeah, definitely. I mean, you're close to the situation, so you know a lot of the details that we don't understand. It is a different ownership. I don't know how many years Chipper played under ownership from Liberty Media. Do you recall?
Yeah. Very end. Yeah. Yeah. It was at the end.
At the very end.
By that point, they weren't gonna let him go. And he wasn't at the top of the pay scale anymore either.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think as a fan, I'm trying to understand and appreciate, if you will, the way that the ownership is working. It's different. Alex Anthopoulos is not working like the Mets, Yankees, and Dodgers. I think he would love to.
Yeah,
I think
it's not his fault.
I think we got to look at it from that perspective. But yeah. Your question is still, am I surprised? Because the strategy of waiting just it increased the amount of money you're going to have to pay. So,
right.
You know, Alex would understand that from signing Acuña and Albies early in their career to club friendly contracts. You make it appealing to them, and you make it early in their career instead of waiting till Acuña wins two MVPs. And so the same thing could apply to Freddie. You make an appeal to him. And I'm sure they're probably going to offer less money in less years than competing teams if it gets to that. But early in this cycle, could have been something very attractive to Freddie, and less money for Liberty Media to pay. But it's interesting. I assume, David, they're looking at analytics and what's going to happen in the time span of his next contract. I don't know, but
right.
The challenge for the Braves is there is going to be a team that's going to offer more money per year and extra years. I mean, I'm just guessing that that's going to be the case. And it's going to be hard for Freddie to say, you know, I had a goal and I wanted to stay here. And Chipper is my guy. And I love what he did in his career. And I love this place. But
yeah.
They're making it hard for Freddie to make that decision. I'll tell you that with this whole thing, you know.
Yeah. We talked about what the difference in what they're going to end up having to pay him to keep him would be. I think if they would have made this move, and again, I understand, you know, coming off the season they did when they lost, when the revenues were so down with nobody there, and the battery just brought that even further down because they're, unlike some teams, they're so dependent on that, you know, the profits from the battery. So when there was no fans, they were not making money. So I understand that. But ultimately, I think this is going to cost them probably if they do re-sign him. And I think it's no longer a given. I went from 100% certain right up till the end of the season. I thought for sure it was going to get done. But now, like you said, you involve other teams now. You open the door. So when before, other teams couldn't make offers. But, I mean, if it only takes one team. And if the Dodgers decide that, you know what, we can play Freddie Freeman at first base. We can let Kershaw go. You know, we can move Max Muncy. And he's not even a given, you know, coming back from the elbow. If the Dodgers throw money at Freddie and go, you know, 6 years, 100, let that 6 year that he's looking for, that guaranteed year, and offer him $190 million, I think the Braves could have got him signed a year ago at this time. I think 6 years would $150 million would have got it done. I really do. I think if you got to 150, maybe even 5 years with an option if you'd got, with a little less than that. But now I think it's going to be 6 years. 180 is what he asked for from what I hear. And I think he's going to get that from somebody, whether it's the Braves, you know, then he's going to have to weigh, what about the cost of living in California, state income tax, all that. But he's from there. He has his mansion in Corona Del Mar. If he can play for the Dodgers, he can live at home. So you got that whole second house thing going. You don't have to move the kids. You don't have to move the wife. Yeah. How much is that worth? You know?
Yeah.
So you got a lot of things to weigh, to consider. And if the Yankees, and how about the Yankees? The Yankees could all of a sudden decide this could be our big move because they haven't done anything yet. Dodgers and the Yankees haven't really done anything yet big in the offseason. Everybody's talking about the Braves sitting on their hands, but all the contenders, none of the biggest teams, the money teams, have really done anything yet, big time yet. The Dodgers, Yankees, the Red Sox, the Braves, they're kind of sitting back and waiting to see how this thing works out with the collective bargaining agreement. So what about if the Yankees throw that much money at him? I know Freddie's not a New York type guy, but Freddie can fit in anywhere, man. I mean, if it came down to somebody out making, and I know his wife, you know, with her business, LA or New York would certainly help with that clothing line she's got and all that. So these are just things to consider that the Braves have complicated it by letting it get to this stage and letting other teams get involved, I think.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know, I might've shared this story with you on a previous podcast before, you know, when I left the Braves under much different circumstances. Mike Schmidt, I went to the Phillies in 90. I'm in the locker room. I'm feeling like so out of place. And Schmidt comes in to the locker room, who he had retired in 89. And he gets real close to me. He goes, you know what? I've always wondered what it's like to play in. I've always wondered what it would have been like to play in another city.
Right.
And Eric, you know, you played for different clubs. I ended up playing for three different clubs. I had a really good experience. I didn't even play that well, especially my short stop with the Rockies. But it was a really good life experience. And I think people need to understand that Freddie, if he leaves, you know, he's going to have a really good experience. He's always going to be a Brave, you know, what he's done there. And I'm not saying Freddie would leave just to get that experience, but it's not a bad thing. It's so seldom that you get to stay that it's really a kind of an eye-opening and great experience to go see what it's like and to experience other things. Is that your experience, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, you get to see how teams travel, you know, what kind of planes they have, what kind of food, you know, just the way everybody else does things. You know, you go to certain teams, if you go to the Yankees, you're treated like a king. You know, I mean, even when you go to the visiting clubhouse, you're eating filet mignon for lunch, you know, and it's every organization, they have different ways that the fans treat you, all these different things. But, you know, for me, that stuff wasn't huge. But I think, you know, in Freddie's case, when you're trying to sign an extension or negotiating with just one team, you're guessing at what you're worth. Now he gets to go and find out what he's worth. You know, what is somebody willing to pay for me? So if it's like the Braves are at 150, another team comes in at 190.
Yeah.
You know, 40 million is, I mean, that's a big gap of this is what I'm worth and this is what they're willing to pay me versus initially you're just kind of guessing, you know, at the discount you're taking to stay. Right. And now he's going to know exactly what that discount is. So I think that puts things in a tough spot.
And it's your last contract too, probably your last big contract. Yeah. The way the sport is skewing younger and younger, chances of Freddie getting another big contract at 38 years old are about zero. You know, he's going to be playing a 1 or 2 year deals at that point.
Yeah.
It's not like Acuña. You know, people feel bad for Acuña, you know, people that he got $100 million guaranteed.
But, and then he blew out his ACL.
Right. So he got that security. And people are still saying that about Albies and Acuña, how the Braves should feel bad for the contracts they gave him. Even after we saw Soroka tear his Achilles for the second time, Soroka would have jumped at a chance and looking back to get $100 million guaranteed.
50, 20, not,
yes,
30,
10. Yes. So Ozzie and Acuña are taken care of and their families are taken care of and the next generation too. Anyway, long story, but Freddie is not going to be like Acuña. When Acuña's contract is up, he's still going to probably get another really big one. He's going to still be probably an elite player, top 10 player, if not top 5, and get one more huge contract. Same thing for Albies, probably get another big one. Freddie's not going to. So Freddie's got to look at it as, this is my chance, my last really big payday. And, you know, as much as he wants to be here, and I know as much as the Braves have said they want him here, and I know they want him here, everybody loves him here, but money talks, man. And if they don't sign him up, and they're waiting, and they're nickel and diamond, and I don't mean to be, you know, to demean what they're doing. because maybe that sixth year is that important to him. But I don't think with Freddie Freeman, you can let a sixth year guarantee be the deciding factor. I mean, come on. What are the chances that between his fifth and sixth year, his performance is really going to decline, that sixth year makes that big a difference? With the DH in the NL, you're going to tell me this guy won't be able to hit at age 38? Come on.
He's always going to hit.
He's going to be a great hitter at 38, I think. I mean, it's hard to predict, but Chipper Jones won a batting title at what, 36, 37? You know? Freddie, Dell, do you think, we've talked about this, do you think Freddie's got the kind of body that's going to be able to maintain being a great hitter for a long time with this simple type swing he has and all that, and the way he's not a real muscle-bound guy that's, you know,
it's all leverage.
Yeah, to me, he seems the perfect type guy that's going to be able to maintain. You know, he hasn't shown signs of breaking down at all. He played 162 games this year, 160.
Yeah, absolutely. And he plays first base, which is right. not like Fred did. Yeah. So like Eric said, he's always going to be able to hit. Can I just throw something in here that I thought was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen from Freddie? His seven straight strikeouts.
How about that?
I'm telling you, that could have put a lot of people, I don't even know how to say it, but
in a postseason.
In a postseason, his ability, and credit Seitzer again, and Freddie, but that could have caused a lot of panic.
Yeah,
and seven straight strikeouts. And you remember what he did? He went to LA, as I recall, and got a few hits to left field.
Yeah,
and just came back. But it's that knife edge. That people don't realize that, man, that could have gone fast.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throw that in. That was a remarkable mental achievement to me and really shows Freddie's ability to know what he's doing and know his swing and not panic, because that would have put a younger player into a panic mode. But getting back to, here's the other thing, his defense at first.
Yeah,
I don't know who they're – you know, he's so tall. He's so good. I don't know, David, you saw him play every day. How many errors did he save? How many runs did he save?
I can't measure it.
You know, tack on another 20, 25 to his RBIs. I mean, he turns a double play. He turns a double play very well. And I've always said, we didn't really get good back in the early 80s till we got Chris Chambliss, a really good first baseman. And, it's going to be a big hole to fill if he does indeed leave. But it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, Eric's talked about how when Angleton was here, you know, the best shortstop any of us have ever seen defensively, at least Eric and I have said that. How many throws Angleton could make, because he had a cannon for an arm. And as long as he got it to Freddie, whether it was one hop or a foot over his head, Freddie's going to catch it. He saved some errors there. But other guys do that all the time. Dansby does that.
Just the confidence it gives you, you know, to know you don't have to be perfect.
Austin Riley, he saves him some errors. And then his presence in the lineup. Imagine the lineup taking Freddie out of the three hole or the two hole where he was sometimes this year. What that's going to do to those guys around him. Austin Riley, the season he would have had if Freddie's not in that lineup. Austin Riley had a career year, breakthrough type year. Does he do that without Freddie in the lineup? Guys, teams still were aiming to stop Freddie, first of all, especially after Acuna got hurt. Freddie was the focus for other teams' pitching staffs to stop Fred. Don't let Freddie beat you. So these other guys beat him as a result, you know, a partial byproduct of that. Guys like Austin Riley, Ozzy, Dansby on some days. You know, when they're focused so hard on stopping Freddie, other guys were killing him.
Yeah.
He's a focal point. I mean, and that's bold if you don't re-sign him, if you think you can replace him. You can get a guy like Olson.
You're not even bringing up his leadership either.
That goes without saying. I mean, he's the leader on the team without even being a loud guy. We've had some loud leaders here, some guys who've wanted to be the leader, you know, and were with certain guys, were able to get certain guys in line and that kind of thing, get snap guys to attention. But Freddie leads by example, and without saying a whole lot, without raising his voice, he leads. He is a great leader that doesn't need the C on his chest. So if you're going to replace him, it better be with a guy like a Matt Olson. with the A's. It better be with a guy who can play both sides of the ball and is a big threat, you know. It better be with somebody that's a big bat, man. I mean, I don't even know if, like, Rizzo, if you replace Rizzo, that's a big drop-off from Freddie to Rizzo, in my opinion.
I just wonder if it's a situation where, you know, they're waiting for him to have an offer to match.
Yeah. And, you hope and, so, and it might be.
And they need to say, you know, he might have told him, which I don't know why, if he would do that, because if I was in his position, I'd definitely be frustrated that it got to this point. And I bet, though, you know, normally with a team, you say, well, whatever we get, we'll give you a chance to match it before we sign with the Yankees or Dodgers or so-and-so. But, I mean, if he gets 180 or 200, I don't know if, you know, I mean, if they are going to match that.
Right, right. Yeah. But I think he has given him that assurance, because as much as he would have wanted this done and he didn't understand why it wasn't done, you know, he never stopped, like, texting with Alex. They're friends, man. Right. I mean, he's got a great relationship with Alex. And that also leads me to – it's not Alex's fault that this isn't done. This is coming from above Alex, you know. And But I think Freddie respects Alex enough to go, look, I'm at least going to come back to you, you know. And
give you
and,
a chance. For sure, yeah.
Because, you know, and Freddie would feel a lot better too if he gets a six-year $180 million offer or $190 million, and he'll feel a lot better about going to the Braves and saying, this is what they've offered, what can you do, than if he doesn't sign it and the Braves later say, we never had a chance to match it, we would have matched that, you know. So he won't. I think he'll be smart to, and I think he will do that.
We'll see.
I still feel better than 50-50s back. But I'm not confident as I was before. I still think they get it done ultimately.
Well, I think just from preparing the fans for the possibility, you know, to me, if I was Freddie, I'd be like, okay, I've been here. What has he been there? 10 years?
11, 12, 11 years? 12, 11, and then a change. September call-up and 11 full season.
Okay. I've won an MVP, you know. I've been the guy. We just won the World Series. I hit a home run my last at bat. I love this place. You know, I love this city. And if I go into the Hall of Fame, I'm wearing an Atlanta Brave hat. They gave me a chance to play. but there's probably a part of him that's saying, I love this organization, but I've done what I can do. And I'm not, you know, we just won the World Series. It's not like we're going to, I want to help this team win a World Series. They just did that.
Yeah. So in that respect, they finished the job. The rebuilding is done. They've reached the ultimate. Right.
Yeah. Might close the whole book on the thing and he'll never have to, if he left, he'd never have to look back at Atlanta with a single negative thought. He can close it and it's just all beauty there. He can always come back.
Exactly. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, just the psychology of it in his mind. I don't know how to describe it, except that there's thinking of what keeps him there is there may not be as much as everybody thinks there is.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. There may not be as much as there would have been if they would have got to the World Series this year and lost after getting so close to the World Series the year before. If they got the World Series and lost this year, he might still be going, we still got to win that World Series, you know?
Yeah, and I want, you know, this is me. This is who I am. Well, he is now. He's going to always be associated with the Braves.
Yeah.
People will look at him.
He's going to be retired.
No matter where he goes, he's not going to be looked at as a Dodger. And he's not going to say that as in himself, and unless he goes back to alumni games at Dodger Stadium, which, you know, I go to Philly once in a while, and I feel like an ex Philly, but most of the time I don't. I'm a Brave, and Freddie has even more depth to his braveness than anybody. He won an MVP. They won a World Series. He had a home run his last at bat. They're great in the community. They might say, you know, we're going to spread our wings a little bit. I'm just trying to prepare fans for that kind of thought.
I tell you what, though, seeing him in another uniform is going to be the most awkward, definitely the most awkward since Tom Glavine in a Mets uniform.
Yeah.
It's going to be weird.
But it's going to be more like, if you can imagine Chipper Jones, say, in a Met,
I know,
or in a Yankee or Dodger uniform. Can you even imagine Chipper in a Dodger uniform? You can't imagine it.
It's weird.
But Freddie will fill it out and look good after. It'll be weird, but he'll do it well. And he might go somewhere else and win another couple of rings. But I just hope, for the Braves' sake, they get this done, because I think they're going to really rue the day that he leaves if they don't, because you can build so much around him. Next year, they're in the eyes of a lot of fans, and I know this will change once they start playing, especially if they start winning. You better hope, God forbid, you don't win next year if you don't sign him and you don't win, because you're going to be a lot of people saying you screwed it up by not bringing him back. But there's going to be a lot of backlash from fans, and I know it's a lot more talking on social media, but there's going to be backlash if they win a World Series and then they don't re-sign Freddie. With fans know how much, because they're the only team that has to show how much profit they're making, because they're publicly owned. So fans know how much revenues are up. And if you don't re-sign Freddie, you better spend that money somewhere and bring in two or three players and spend it somewhere. Because if you don't spend it, there's going to be some pissed off people, especially if you don't win next year again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be fascinating to watch, and the lockout, the whole thing. It's there's going to be a lot going on this winter.
It just complicates things even more that we're sitting there now, and the limbo is like halted. It's like you can't even get any news right now, because they're not technically supposed to even talk to him. So it's very weird, man.
Really weird.
Speaking of this lockout, you were involved in how many strikes or lockouts during work stoppages during your career, Murph?
I think 81 was the big one. Players missed, I think, almost 60 games. I think 56 games. Mm-hmm. That was a rough one during the season. I think we had a couple of delayed spring trainings. And then did we miss a few games in the season in 88, Dave?
88, because Dodgers won the World Series that year, and they didn't play. It was like 150 games or something like that. And then 94, 95, 94 season was obviously.
Yeah.
Well, you were still going,
I was gone. I was gone in 93. In 93. So I missed that terrible year of 94.
That was the worst. Because they wiped out the postseason of World Series, and that's the one that lost. They lost a lot of fans for a lot of years. Some fans say they never came back to the game after that. They were so pissed.
Yeah.
They took away the World Series and a postseason.
Yeah. But, let's hope it looked dicey for a while. I think, isn't that your kind of gut reaction, David, that things are going to be a little scary, maybe delayed spring training, but got to get it worked out.
Well, they were really smart to have this CBA expire when it did. So where you have this ramp up like 2-3 months to get it done without missing games. That was really smart, rather than have expired during a season like the one that was. How'd that ever happen? So I think cooler heads will prevail. There's still a big disparity between what they want, what the players want, and what the owners want. There's still significant disparity, though. And you got a feeling the way they do things, they won't even start really negotiating until we get closer to a deadline, unfortunately. I could see spring training starting late, but you guys know. Couldn't you get by with pitchers are the only ones, and I think they would tell the pitchers, start getting your arms in shape even before camp. But couldn't we get by with 3 weeks of spring training and play the regular start the season on time?
Every time I think about making a comeback, I think about spring training and shut it back down. Spring training's like, for me, 4 weeks too long. As a reliever, I felt like I needed 2 weeks to get ready. I think hitters and starting pitchers need more, but if you know there's going to be a delay, you could work out at a high school and pitch against those guys and run around and get yourself ready. You don't need the full 6 weeks, but I definitely think it'll drag into spring training.
I think it'll be like during the pandemic when several of the players got together at a local high school and they had competitive at bats, but they were facing big league hitters. I think you'll have some agents like Boris will get a lot of his clients together who live in Southern California, and he's also got an office in Florida. We'll get them more, or he's got a training facility in Florida and a training facility in Southern California. Get about 10 of his clients together and each of those working out. I mean, you could do it where you could start getting ready, you know, for abbreviated spring training. But I think they would do that in a heartbeat rather than start the season 3 weeks late by trying to get in a full 5 or 6 weeks of spring. I think you could do it in 3 weeks.
Yeah, but you're going to have so many free agents floating around.
Oh, man, it's going to be a madhouse signing free agents. It's going to be crazy for that week before. If they get this settled, all right, we're opening camps. You know, next week, there's going to be guys signing left and right.
Yeah, and then they'll play hardball, too, and make guys try to take one-year deals.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why there was that flurry before.
Right.
You know, both sides wanted to get something done before this happened. But
the teams could be ugly. The teams like the Angels and the Mets that absolutely had to get some holes filled, they weren't going to wait and go through this limbo. Yeah. And so, like, as a result, you see a guy like Scherzer just blow through the previous barriers, the pay standards. Yeah. Here's a guy that's closer to 40 than 30, and he's going to get over $40 million a year.
It's wild.
I mean, he's going to be
What's that 30s? Like seeing that, Dale, from your playing days and looking at that?
Is those
and
your then career guys earnings, are making... Dale?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Nancy and I always, every year, we're like, man alive. But like we always say, it's generational. I mean, you know, I got top dollar when I played for my generation, so it's hard to complain. You know, all you got to do is look at what Hank made.
Yeah.
And it keeps it in perspective. But I'd love to be playing now. I don't have any doubt about that. It's a different situation, but, you know, happy for the players. I mean, like you said earlier, Eric, it's kind of what, you know, what are you worth? Well, what are people going to pay you?
Right. That's
what you're worth.
Right. Yeah.
And so more power to them. I feel kind of thankful that I was at a chance. I didn't go through the 60s and 70s with free agency, but my first spring training was 75. I mean, I got to know Marvin Miller and listen to his talks and see the foundation of why players are making what they're making.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And actually go through some strikes. We were always told that this is for the future. This is for the good of the players. You're going to have to just take it. And, you know, people ask me about hitting 400 home runs. I hit 398. You know, I missed 50-some games in 1981. You know, I would have got over that 400 mark, but I should be over the 400 mark anyway. I had enough pitches to hit. But my point is that, you know, we were in a position, Marvin Miller and Don Fair got us to the position of we are doing this for the future of the players. Yep. And then I think about, you know, Curt Flood and all the guys that went through what they did to get this to the point to where we could really see what players are worth. It's interesting to watch. And I'm thankful for those early days. I might say one thing, too. In 81, word got down to all of us. We did work out, but word got down to all of us is do not let anybody know if you work out. In fact, we want them to think that you are not working out at all, that you're getting heavy, you're out of shape. Because the more you guys work out, the more you guys work out, the longer this is going to go. So we did work out, but it's like a top secret operation. You know,
that's interesting.
Yeah. When you think about the psychology, I know guys, you know, it's hard not to, but Don Fehr and Marvin were like, do not publicize this. There wasn't as much social media. Mm-hmm. That's why we were able to work out in secret, but it was a different strategy back then. Oh. It was like, do not stay in shape.
Well, I like that, though, because if you're sitting here thinking, you know, maybe Acuna's going to put on 60 pounds if we don't get this thing going.
Yeah.
You know, no, I mean, you could have some prize pieces that really get out of shape. And
yeah. Well, yeah. you got to stay together as a group, too. You can't say, what are we doing?
Right.
We can't get this workout. All I want to do is play. And the killer for the players is when players start going, hey, we're making enough money.
Yeah.
Then it's like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
You know, I remember sitting with Ted Simmons, who was a key figure through all of the early days. And we were watching the NFL try to – the early days of NFL bargaining where they were trying to get some rights in the 80s. And Ted was just shaking his head. He said, these guys will never do it because everybody was complaining enough about not playing. Highest paid football players – we're saying, what are we doing? We're making enough money. Yeah. Let's just play. and Ted Simmons is just sitting there shaking his head.
Yeah.
And if anybody needed rights and guarantees, it is the NFL.
And look at it. It's like that today. Look at their union today. It's nothing compared to the baseball union. And that's the union that should be the strongest. They should have the guaranteed contracts.
Absolutely.
The guys with the brain injuries and the careers that are 3 years and all that, average career.
Health benefits for the rest of your life.
Yep.
I mean, they should be. I mean, it was just an entry. I think it'd be another great movie. The inner workings of those years with Marvin Miller. I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is.
Well, he finally got in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, he did. That was an interesting thing, but I'm happy that he got recognized, but I understand his stance. He didn't, you know, the way they treated him, he didn't want to be in there, but
yeah. Yeah. Murph, speaking of the Hall of Fame, 6 new members. I was glad to see this. I'm part of the committee that put together the early days ballot. And so I was really hoping the early baseball ballot. I was really hoping to see some guys get elected. And because it was 2 different era committees, which is it used to be the Veterans Committee. Now it's separated into 4 different eras. 6 guys elected to this class. So it's going to be a big class, especially if you get in 3 or 4 more players added to it. It could be an all-time class. You know, there's already 6 from the eras, though. So I was really happy to see at that long overdue Buck O'Neill. That's why I'm wearing my Kansas City Monarchs hat today for Buck O'Neill.
There you go.
Buck O'Neill, Manny Manosa. Those are 2 guys that when you if you take the time to go back and look and see what they did, I mean, they should have been in long ago. But they got in along with a buddy. I think you played against Jim Cott late in his career. Jim Cott gets in, another long overdue. Gil Hodges, Tony Oliva, and Bud Fowler. So 6 guys. Just a couple of others I think should have got in out of that class, but out of those eras. But I think that's really encouraging to see this, starting to budge a little on this and get some guys in it that were long overdue in. And it gives me hope for these next for the modern baseball era. And today's game era, that some more guys will get in that are deserving, such as yourself and Fred McGriff.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Dave, I mean, what can I say? Except that I'm excited for those guys. I'd like to see Richie Allen in. I think he'd
yes,
just,
Dick Allen.
Dick
number
Allen.
Number 1.
Yes.
Number 1 should have got in.
I think he just missed.
By 1 vote.
Looks good for him in the future. So, yeah, it's a fascinating process again to watch to see how the Hall of Fame people say, hey, you know, what do you think? And I always say, I'm thankful the Hall of Fame did what they did. This has really given a lot of people a different perspective on our careers.
Yeah.
I'm not a first ballot Hall of Famer. I knew that, but I still got a shot. So I'm thankful that they're doing it this way. And we'll see. I think I'm up in 2 years. I think.
2 years.
Of course, you got to get on the ballot, which is part of it. And then, but I got to share something. When I saw Gil Hodges' name, when I moved to the outfield, everybody said, you know, Murph, I don't know anybody who's gone from catcher to the outfield except Gil Hodges. Maybe there were others, but people always brought up Gil's name. And so I think we'll see. I got some comparables in there, and we'll just see, David. I'm thankful that the Hall of Fame is considered a way of doing this eras that really focuses in on different eras. I guess that's the best way to say it. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's a much better way of doing it because you can look and compare players to their era, numbers to their era, rather than looking at numbers, because some numbers, they're almost irrelevant comparing eras because the game changed so much. You know, there's been so many different changes to the game, the size of ballparks, the height of the mound, everything. You know?
That's going to happen in the future too, because we're not going to have 300 game winners.
Exactly.
So, you can't compare past 300 game winners to dominant pitchers like a DeGrom.
Right.
He's probably case number 1.
You know,
this guy is a dominating pitcher, and Kershaw, I don't know how many wins he's got, 200 or so, but it's going to have to be flexible as we move forward. So I'm thankful again for the chance to be considered.
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar with it yet, the eras, there's four eras. Today's game, which is 1988 to the present, and the era that you're in, if it overlaps between eras, it's the era that you were judged to have had the most impact during your career. So the modern baseball era is 1970 to 87. So that's obviously Murph's era would be that, because he won your two MVPs in that era, right? So your modern baseball era. Then there's the golden days, 1950 to 1969, and the early baseball, which is prior to 1950. We just did the two together, golden days and early, because the pandemics that changed everything. And so they did the two together, two eras together. And they folded the Negro Leagues into it now for consideration. Again, long overdue. So long now you're getting a lot of those guys finally get in. More of those guys get in now that their statistics are recognized as big league statistics are right there, comparable to big league statistics. So and coming up, you're going to have today's game is next year for the class of 23. And then we'll have, and that'll be Fred McGriff, by the way. He would be considered in that class.
Yeah.
So Fred could be considered next year. I mean, I just think it's criminal that Fred McGriff, pardon the pun, crime dog, that Fred McGriff, this is a guy that literally without the strike has 500 home runs. His numbers across the board. This is not a guy like with a low average or low OBP or didn't play every, was a DH. He played first base almost primarily till the end, till 40. And 30 home runs again and again and again. I just don't, and he played on championship teams. So I don't see the knock why Fred McGriff, other than he moved around from team to team, so he's not identified. But I said this about Andrew Jones. If Fred McGriff had the career he had and he spent most of it or all of it in New York, he's maybe first ballot Hall of Famer if he plays his whole career with the Yankees. He might be a first ballot Hall of Famer, and he didn't even get in on 10 ballots.
Yeah,
it's a joke. It's a joke.
Fred, you said it all. I'm shaking my head, hoping for him, because it to me it's a no-brainer for Fred. And Andrew, Andrew still on the present?
Yeah, he's on the
right. He's still got a chance.
He's still on the ballot. He's got plenty of years left, and he's got enough of a jump the last 2 years to really look as though he's got a real shot. Now, it might be another 3-4 years before he gets real close, but I think he's got a real shot. And I think people are finally recognizing what he did. I mean, I've had this debate. I debated it on MLB Network the other day. Jason Stark, I love him. He knows more about baseball than almost anybody I know. But Jason said that he was on a committee, and Andrew, guys like Andrew, what hurts them is they didn't do enough after age 30. And I'm like, but Andrew debuted at age 19. So if Andrew debuts at age 23, then he doesn't fall off till age 34. And he played almost every day for 11 years. He played 155 to 162 for 11 years and won 10 straight gold gloves in that span and hit over 400 home runs. 10 straight gold gloves.
Jeez.
So I think as analytics have gotten so big now, I don't think anybody that goes back and looks at the importance of defense can say Andrew Jones is not a Hall of Famer. I don't care what the batting average is.
Oh,
it ain't that low. This is a guy that you're talking about doing on both sides of the ball.
You ask Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz.
Yeah.
If he's a Hall of Famer. I think there's a number of people, Bobby Cox for one, I think, said he's the best center fielder they've ever seen.
Willie Mays said it.
Okay, well, there you go.
Willie Mays came up to him. Andrew's talking to Terry Pendleton. Terry Pendleton told me this story. Andrew's talking to TP before a game in San Francisco when Andrew's still playing. Willie walks over and says, Andrew, you're the best I've ever seen. Says it to him. Willie freaking Mays, right then, they should have said, okay, Hall of Fame, we got it. We don't need the vote.
Willie Mays just said it.
Willie Mays just said it. By the way, number one player in Joe Posnanski's butt is Willie.
Willie.
And, he's
hard to argue.
One.
I know everybody says Babe Ruth, but I don't think you could argue if you say Willie Mays or if you said Hank Aaron. I don't think anybody can argue. You know?
Absolutely. Willie was – anyway, that's – well, there you go. I got to get my – who said what straight? If Willie Mays said it.
Came up to him on the field in San Francisco, I guess it would have been a candlestick, and said, "You're the best I've ever seen."
Yeah. No, it'll happen for him. It'll happen.
So Fred is being considered for a class of 23 next year. And then the modern era is the year after that. So that's you 2 years from now for the class of 24. You can be back on the ballot and be considered. So I got my hopes up.
Thank you, but thank you so much, David.
Unfortunately, Dick Allen, man, the way this thing is, the schedule that they have, he's going to have to wait 5 years. Well, he's not wait. He's died now, but he's not going to come up for consideration for five more years, and that's a shame because he's so close now. Yeah. One vote away. You look at this guy's career. I just don't understand. This guy was a dominant player for 5-6 years at least. And for a decade, he was a great player.
Oh, man. I used to watch him on TV as a kid. I'm like, how big is that bat?
Yeah.
How much does it weigh? And then he also had some swagger. I mean.
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
He looked good in a uni.
Yeah. And the shit he had to deal with, the racism and all that, and Bish being disrespected because he wouldn't acquiesce. He wouldn't suck up to people. He said what was on his mind. Nowadays, people would love that he would be a huge hit in the game nowadays. But back then, it would get you blackballed, you know?
Yeah.
He would be celebrated now for the swagger and the personality he brought to the game. And nowadays, unfortunately, guys back then, especially black guys back then, were shunned for it. It sucks. So anyway, I think we're coming around and getting a better Hall of Fame, improving it all the time. The people that say, you know, that are small haulers, I'm like, okay, I want a small Hall of Fame too, if it just means only having elite players in. But those elite players need to be in, because they've let a few players in that were not elite, you know, that might have played for the right team, the right time, and had great relationships with the writers or whatever. Get the great best players to belong in the Hall of Fame, period.
Right. So, again, it's this era committee was well thought out. I mean, it obviously gives me another chance, so I like it, but it is. Just to see what's happening with the old timers, the golden era and before that and the Negro Leagues. I mean, it's about time. I mean, it's way, way overdue.
He's an icon there in Kansas City, but around baseball, there's never been a better ambassador for the game beyond what he did on the field. So I think it's great that they're finally recognizing these guys and getting guys in that some insist were as good as any big leaguers ever. It's, you know, the best Negro League players.
Absolutely.
So it's cool. It's cool what they're doing. It's cool the improvements we're seeing in the game. So and just speaking to it, how important is it? You hate seeing these guys get voted in after they're dead and gone, and you know, I can't appreciate it, because man, what it would have done for Buck O'Neill to see it, to be able to see it happen, you know. It would have just been so cool to see him, because he gave that speech when he introduced him, the first Negro League Hall of Famers that were inducted. He gave that speech, that memorable speech where he had the crowd singing at Cooperstown. Yeah. So to see him go in, man, you want to see guys go in while they're alive, man. Don't let it be like Dick Allen and go in after they're dead, you know. It's just so much more important. Ron Santo, you know.
Yeah. I texted Nance. I said, hey, you know, it's kind of interesting to see who goes into the Hall of Fame. You know, they're dead, but I got a shot. and I said, Nance, I might have to die, Nance. And she says, well, don't do that. You know, it was kind of funny. And it is. It is sad. It's good, and they're honoring him, but I couldn't agree with you more to work this out, while the guys are living, and let them celebrate.
Hey, Murph, last thing before we go, because I've seen this come up a few times about when they talk about Freddie Freeman might not get re-signed, and somebody said, you know, Schurrholz wouldn't let that happen. Oh, Schurrholz is the guy who traded Murphy. Well, he didn't trade you. Bobby Cox did.
Yeah.
But for the record, could you explain to people why you didn't really get screwed at all? You don't view it as you got screwed. You thought it was time to, when you did get traded, right? You agreed with it at the time.
Yeah.
Is that, am I correct there?
Right. In a nutshell, exactly. It was 1990. We were struggling, and I had been struggling. My last couple of years before then, I mean, 87, I had a good year, 88, 89, and going into 90. So I was going to be a free agent in 91. And so I told Bobby, who was GM and manager at the time, I just went into his office. I said, Bobby, Nancy and I, we've decided it's just time. I've been here. I've had a great experience, but I'm going to be a free agent next year. I said, but if there's a trade, you know, if you want to explore a trade, I'll certainly consider it. And so, yes, I was looking at, David, just to reemphasize, I was looking at being a free agent at 34 with not having two previous good years, to when the Phillies said, we'll take Murph and sign him to an extension of a year.
Right.
Or no, a couple of years. So I was like, no, it worked out. Yeah. I was like, I don't want to go on the free agent market. The Phillies have just extended me, and they want me, and they think I got something left. And so, no, it worked out well, because I was looking at that decision as who knows what I would have got. But the Phillies were like, we'll take Murph. We're going to extend his contract, I think, 2 years. And I was like, dang, after the years I've had in 88, 89, and at my age,
yeah,
I'm gonna jump at this. So, no, it did work out well, but it is a little confusing because all the Braves fans saw Braves trade Murphy. And I have to explain it. I thought I explained it back then, but people just are passionate and they don't understand. It just wasn't the ability to go behind the scenes and explain to everybody. Right. So that's what
social media.
So, no,
you
could have, it worked
out. You could have
out.
Said it in a post social media post now if it happened.
It worked out for me. No question about it. It was, it was good. But yeah, so again, getting back to the Freddie situation, I think Freddie's in a situation where he's going to look good no matter what happens. I mean,
yeah,
that not that you worry about that too much, but you do kind of worry about your legacy and things, how things are handled professionally. That's you want to do it right. And the Braves never mistreated me in any way or threw me into Philadelphia. That was a decision of mine and Nancy's. Yeah. And again, to reiterate, I had a great experience in Philadelphia. It's a great place to play. I didn't play that well, but it is a passionate sports town, and I had a good experience.
And Freddie, for the people out there, I hate when I see people turn. They see Freddie is asking for 6 years and $180 million. The Braves offered 5 years and $135 million. Well, if Freddie's going to hold out for the biggest money, then let him go. We can replace him. That sucks, because Freddie is the last guy. Freddie said was more open about wanting to stay than I've ever seen any player be open about that. And he was saying it more than a year ago. He was saying, I want to resign here. Hopefully he'll get it. And I really think if the Braves had made him a fair offer a year ago, he would have signed for a lot less than he can get now. A lot less than he can get now from another team. So, and when you start negotiations, well, of course you're going to start at 6 years, $180 million. When you look at what other players are making now, Freddie's still in the prime of his career. He's just the MVP last year. You know, $30 million a year is fair for Freddie, what he is. So even if he doesn't get that, that's where you're going to start negotiations. You're not going to start at 150, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I hate seeing anybody speak poorly about Freddie, because he's the last guy to hold the Braves to the grindstone and squeeze every last dollar out of them that he could. It's not him. And, you know, he's the one that took all the risks this year playing without a contract, without, going to free agency. He could have blown his ACL out like Acuna did. Then where is Freddie sitting right now, you know, or his Achilles, you know? So he's the only one that took him the risk this year, not the team.
I couldn't agree with you more. And he's played under a pretty friendly contract his whole career. So,
It was a very fair contract when they gave it to him. He outperformed it like crazy the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
Yep.
Right. So I mean, it's going to. I can't wait to see how it plays out. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
To me. It really is, because I love Freddie. I love the Braves, and this is one of those situations. It's going to be fascinating to watch, because it's just going to be interesting. And but I think we can all agree that both sides are, you know, good people, and they're not going to be underhanded. It's no one's trying to make over on anybody. It is business. It's big business.
and Alex, I think most people understand too. This isn't Alex saying I'm not going to give Freddie a dime more. Alex is a good dude who's doing what he can with the budget that he has, and he's trying to look at it as I still have to do this, this, and this. If they sign Freddie, it's going to push the budget up around 170, and you still got some other needs that you have to fill. Not a lot, but you got some. So he's got to be smart about it, and he's got to look down the line too, because he has no idea what his budget's going to be 6 years from now. Yeah. So he's working within what he's given, so I don't blame him at all.
Not easier to be a GM in other cities.
Like the Dodgers, like his buddies with the Dodgers, knowing that you're always going to be at the very top of the payroll. Right. 250, and by in another 5 years, be 350 probably.
It's easier.
All right, hey Murph, man, it was great having you. Thank you so much for giving us the time you did, and hopefully, we're talking about you in the Hall of Fame a couple years from now, man.
Thank you so much, Eric and David. Always love to be on with you guys. I could keep going. So have me on again, and I think we'll have a lot to talk about here coming up.
Pretty soon.
We'll get you on here with Michael Kelly, and we could talk about The Sopranos. And did you see that one? Yeah. He was great, man.
Yeah, I was a different one. Michael, we didn't hook up during the playoffs, but he says, "Hey, I'm here. Where you at?" And it was, as you get, it's chaotic.
Yes.
I think it was the World Series, actually. So much chaos, but
it was a madhouse, man.
Yeah. I'd love to come on and with him. And
he's hardcore. He's a hardcore fan.
Yes, he is.
All right. That's it. 7:55 is real, and we are out. Thanks, everybody.